Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Our guest is the award-winning video game, TV, and film composer Gary Scheiman, who's created the music for such popular video games as, to name just a few, BioShock, BioShock 2, BioShock Infinite, Middle-Earth, Shadow of War, and Torn. As one of the most acclaimed composers of video game music at work today, Scheiman has been praised for his stylistic versatility as well as his richly eclectic taste in musical source material. Scheiman began his career working as a compositional assistant on such classic 1980s TV shows as The A-Team and Magnum P.I. He's also done a lot of orchestral film scoring over the years, and he basically started writing music for video games right around when video games were becoming a staple of American popular culture. Scheiman also teaches scoring part-time at the University of Southern California, his alma mater, and he's currently a J. Donald Fagen visiting artist here at TU. Working with University of Tulsa film scoring as well as computer gaming students, he spoke with Rich Fisher last week.
Gary Scheiman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Your career began as video games were in their infancy, and of course you were in television in really the last golden age for television composers where the theme songs were hummable, and, you know, it was a sort of a golden age in many ways. And you started on programs like Magnum PI and A-Team, where you were working with Mike Post and Pete Carpenter. Did you ever imagine you'd be working on video games in a career much later? And just imagine what a creative media video gaming has been for film composers and scoring composers.
No, actually, I had really no sense that that was where some very exciting creative work was headed. You know, they were in their infancy then in the 80s, and I was happily writing film and television music. So even when the first video game started to get musical scores, they were very primitive. They were basically MIDI, which was a musical digital interface, that was sending data to a very simple synth engine and was just sort of triggering a mono synth line. And there was some very clever and nice and cool music that was written back then. I don't mean to demean it in any way, but it just wasn't what I was doing. And I was writing, you know, sort of more orchestral music or whatever. So really then in the early 90s, I did work on a new technology from Philips Interactive called CDR. And you had, because of this newfangled CD technology, you could actually record real recordings and then compress them into the game. So those, I did a few for Philips. Philips was a short-lived technology. And then I just went back, you know, just a friend of mine from high school literally was working at Philips. So I just had an opportunity to do a few projects, and they paid me, and I was done. But it wasn't until the late 1990s when you had the Xbox and the Sony PlayStation that you really all of a sudden opened up a world of really interesting opportunities, because the technology was so advanced by these two hardware products. So that was really when it got cool. And then in 2004, I had an agent without even, he didn't even mention that he was doing this, but he, of course, his job is to find me work. So he sent my resume over to THQ, which was a video game publisher. The publishers are like what you think of as a studio, like Paramount is a studio.
Sure.
Well, in video game industry, they're the publishers. That's like the studio. And then the production company would be in films, the equivalent in a game would be the developer. So he sent it over to the publisher, and someone there thought I might be a good fit for a project they had, Destroy All Humans. Which is a game where you, a tongue-in-cheek game where you come to Earth as an alien, a little green alien in the 1950s, and you try to steal brain matter. And they wanted, the thing that made it intriguing was they wanted a score a la a 1950s sci-fi score, as Bernard Herrmann's score for The Day the Earth Stood Still, which had this theremin, early electronic instrument and orchestra. And it just sounded like great fun and an opportunity. And I had a fantastic time. And in the 90s, a lot of television was going towards synths and samples, no live instruments, because they just didn't want to spend the money, and they thought, that sounds good enough for TV.
And there was a time when literally the score was virtually nothing. I mean, I was mentioning, you know, the early 80s when you first started really working, you know, it was a time of these great themes that we still remember today. There weren't even any theme songs, you know, much
absolutely.
less.
That was a golden, you know, someone once said, you don't know it's a golden era when you're in it. You only know afterwards. So to us, it was just, that was what it was. But yeah, it was a cool and golden and fantastic opportunity because I was just writing for an orchestra each week. And that was all, you're just writing on paper and pencil, very traditional way of writing music. But then all of a sudden with these games, there was orchestras. There was money for orchestras. That was not a problem for them. And so that was really cool because I love writing for live instruments and love writing for orchestra. And so I had this opportunity on Destroy Humans, and I just took it and ran. I really focused on getting involved in the gaming industry. And then I got an opportunity that the audio director actually for Destroy Humans, a woman named Emily Ridgway, went on to become the audio director for Irrational Games, and they were making BioShock.
This is a huge game.
Yes.
I've never played it, but I've just seen enough about it to know that this is a huge game in which you could go out and do a concert and you could get a concert hall full of BioShock fans just to come to listen to music.
There are huge BioShock fans.
You've done
fans.
That actually, haven't
I've,
you?
I've, my music has been performed actually just recently in Cologne by the WDR, which is their radio orchestra,
right.
Played a concert of video game music and a whole suite of music from BioShock. There's three BioShock games, and I've scored all three, BioShock 1, BioShock 2, and BioShock Infinite. And yeah, I produced a suite from all three games. And last year, I created a BioShock Symphony that was performed in Madrid, Spain, and many places in America have performed. So yes, it's enormous interest in this music and these games, really, because the games are what generate the interest, but then people do appreciate the scores, which is very cool. So BioShock was just, I had no idea when I was working on it that it was going to be an enormous success.
But isn't that the case with every film or television project you do? You know, you don't know if for television, you don't know if it's going to be, you know, 13 weeks or 8 years.
Absolutely. You could have something that you think is going to be a huge hit bombs totally.
And I actually dated myself by saying 13 weeks because nowadays it's about 4 weeks or 3 weeks.
Right. Well, for films, actually, you'd be surprised. Sometimes yeah. You do get 12 weeks to score a film,
yeah. Which
is very different from a game where sometimes you're on a game for a year. That's
really?
Not uncommon, which, to be honest with you, I'd prefer it a little shorter because I'm used to film and TV schedules. And, you know, you're not writing music every day for it. You're kind of on and off working. You'll be in fits and starts. You write a bunch of music and then nothing for maybe a week or two and then a bunch of music. And then often at the very end of the process, there's a crunch. I think this is generally true of games, that the 80% of the game is made in the last 20% of the time allotted to make the game. So that's when a lot of the music gets produced at the very end of the process.
Is it the same sort of crunch schedule where, you know, you may be putting themes out, but you're not sitting in front of a symphony orchestra until everything's set, right?
Right. You yeah. don't record the orchestra into the end because that's the most cost-effective way
yeah.
to do it. In BioShock Infinite, interesting enough, because we didn't use an orchestra, it was like small string ensembles from between 3 and 10 players. I actually recorded it as we went and had many, many sessions. But that was just an interesting creative way of working on that, and it worked out very well. But 99.99% of the time, you can record the orchestra at the end because you're going to have gotten all the music finished, approved, and then you're going to go in and record the orchestra. And that is a very, you know, one of the most expensive things you can do in scoring a film or a television show or a game is a live orchestra because it's a lot of musicians. And so that's done quickly as possible at the end.
Now, the popular image of scoring composers and how you record the music is, you know, composers watching a silent film and you're coordinating things to it, either to time or to the actual passage. I don't know how real that is in real life, but I would think for a game project, that's just not possible because, you know, the end user has the say over what's going to happen within the score. You're just conducting
right.
a series
but you're
of...
Still, you're still writing music in loops, mm-hmm. for instance, is, right. is still very commonly used. But then if you have a layer of that loop, you might record that cue as well, and then they work together, and then they may cross. You may not hear all that music, but they're there, and they're prepared based upon what the player does to synchronize with the player's free will as they play the game. So there's techniques. Obviously, there has to be a technique, otherwise you wouldn't be able to record anything. You'd be stymied. So there's ways to do it, and interesting enough, there is almost always a certain portion of the game that is almost identical to a film, because there's these in-game, often almost always CGI movies.
That's true.
That you're scoring. And in fact, on Shadow of War, I wrote 2.5 hours of music for that game, for Warner Brothers and Monolith Games. And that was an hour worth of in-game CGI movies. So it was like scoring a film and a game. And that was just part of the whole creative process. So you're scoring scenes identical to scoring a film, and then you're writing all this other music, in-game music, that is done in a variety of techniques based on where it's going to be used. And then someone has designed these interactive designs for any particular portion of the score.
You know, I think of a lot of that as being akin to like how television series used to work, where they would have a whole set of cues that would show up and you would hear them because they were cheap.
Star Trek.
They were cheap and they would use them week after week after week.
It's like a library, yes.
Right. And I think it's pretty much the same, except one of the things I think is really interesting is in a really well-crafted video game, you transition, despite the fact that you as the end user are sort of determining what's going to be heard. The transitions are so smooth that it seems like it's almost written.
Right. Well, that's where the techniques come in. That's really where we do our job. And sometimes it's just literally there's software called middleware that's audio-based, and that middleware is very sophisticated. It knows it has triggering mechanisms, and you can say when the player does this, then goes through this door into the enchanted forest, this piece of music starts, and it can happen on the millisecond. And maybe at the same time, that door is creaking, so there's additional audio of the door creak, and then maybe you see someone on the other side going, hello, welcome to whatever, and so that's all part of this very sophisticated software that's triggering audio. And then you fall down the rabbit hole, and the music changes, okay, and it crossfades very rapidly. When you do, maybe different players are going to get to the rabbit hole at different times. Maybe Alice doesn't get there as quickly one time in one player. I'm just suggesting an Alice in Wonderland game.
Yeah, right.
So and then the music transitions, and it can be just a quick crossfade, but it's all done in time based upon what the player is doing.
So a lot of things you've said is very akin to film scoring. Are there anything that's really different about doing a video game score as opposed to a film score?
Well, really they're doing the same thing, excepting that in the games you're not locked to very, very specific imagery. So, in a scene in a film or in a cinematic in-game cut scene, that when the guy with the sword runs after the other guy, that happens at a very specific moment to the millisecond. It's always in the same place. But of course, the interactive music, you never know when that something like that's going to happen. So you have to write the music with those sorts of options and triggers and stingers to sting a specific thing. And so all of this is sort of planned out ahead of time, and that's what really makes it interesting. And I teach a course at USC, University of Southern California, on scoring for video games, and those techniques is part of what I teach and talk about in that class.
I guess there is Gary Scheiman, a video game, film, and television composer. He's a J. Donald Fagan visiting artist at the University of Tulsa, talking to film scoring and computer gaming departments about his work, which goes all the way back to, I think, some of your first big breakthroughs were Magnum P.I. and A-Team.
Yes.
Those are classic.
Very cool.
And, it's music that we remember to this day. I mean, it's...
Now, I did not write the theme.
No, I know. No,
Mike and Pete did. I was one of their ghosts and worked on many of those shows. And
So what did you learn? I mean, that was probably one of your earlier experiences. I know you'd done a couple of...
I was just out of college, and they hired me, thank goodness. And it was amazing. It was stressful at times. You would really go in on a Thursday, and you would spot, which means you find out, you'd make creative decisions about where the music goes and where it comes in and where it goes out. And then once you have that information, then there's a music editor that sends you a list of all the cues, where they start and stop. And then I sat down at the piano and had sheet music in front of me, and I would, improvise and play around and come up with an idea that seemed appropriate. And actually, I had a video cassette recorder on my piano, and on top of that, a television set. And I would watch the scene, and then I'd write music for it, and then I would put it on pencil on the paper, and then someone would come over from the studio and pick up those cues, and then those had to get copied, meaning that a music copyist has to take and individually create the parts for all the different instruments because, you know, the oboist does not want to see what the French horn or the double bass player is playing. And then it gets put on the music stands at the session before the players, you know, get there or while they're showing up. And then you show up and then someone gets out and conducts the orchestra. And then it gets recorded and then it gets on the air like the next day or something, you know.
Wow. Amazing schedule back then.
It was very tight. It was a very tight schedule and it was nerve-wracking, but it was great experience for me.
Now, how much freedom did you have in a situation? I've always wondered how much when you're a ghost composer, and this is still very prominent in films, probably even in video games to this day, that you'll have people helping you and sort of sketching out ideas, perhaps more in film and television. How much creative freedom do you have in that? Do you have to sort of follow what the head composer's view of it?
You're definitely working for the head composer. You know, if your music doesn't sound like part of the score, if your cues sound like they're from a different
different
show,
planet,
a different show, maybe, you know, it's Magnum PI, but it sounds like Perry Mason or something. It's like it's wrong, and then you're not going to work very long for that composer. So part of what you have to do is sound like that particular, using the themes, using the types of harmonic language and melodies that were common. So I mean, once you got that and you knew that what you were expected, because if no one was looking over your shoulder that much. Initially, when I first started, I was bringing my music over to Pete Carpenter's home, and he would like listen to them and make comments. But after a while, it was like they trusted you to do it. And now, if you really screwed up, you probably would have lost your job. So you were aware of that. You weren't wanting to. You were wanting to continue to make a living. So.
Yeah, this is creativity.
So they trusted you after a while. Right. You knew what you're doing. You understood the show. You understood the style and the themes for that show. And you cranked. You know, everybody was just doing their job.
And those composers, I mean, they almost defined that era of television. I mean, when you think of so many themes and so many
Rockford Files,
right? Saint Elsewhere,
Hill Street Blues.
That's right.
It was really, and that the style that they created was that what made it unique was it was like an orchestra with a rock band inside of it. And literally when we recorded, I remember we used to go over to different studios, but a lot at Universal, you would have like 12 violins, 6 celli, 3 trumpets, 3 horns, 3 trombone, percussion, 2 percussionists. And some woodwind players, and then you had the band, and the band sat together in one group. So you had a keyboard player who'd play like piano and clavinet and some synthesizer. You'd have a guitar player, you'd have a bass, an electric bass player, and you'd have a drummer, and that was the band. And so that was like the band was definitely part of the sound of that, along with the orchestra. So that was that was new to the world of scoring back then and made them very popular.
But it sounds like your great love is standing in front of an orchestra. Is it? Or
I do love recording an orchestra. That is a very cool thing. We're in a very synthesized time from the perspective of the composer. A lot of the scores we hear these days are synthesizer. It's just very popular. And yet we still also have a lot of orchestral scores and a lot of hybrid of both synthesized, and I do a lot of that too, where there's synthesizers. I love synthesizers. I use them all the time. And so that becomes part of the orchestral vibe, you know. But the score that I just had come out for Torn was pretty much all orchestral. It was just really, there was some synths in it, but not much. Mostly orchestral. It was just, that was the style that they wanted. And I was happy to do it.
Now, BioShock, this was, you won numerous awards for the scores in this particular game, and games, I should say. That used both popular music from the 50s, 40s and 50s, along with your original score. Was that something you had to work out how to make the game work, where you might have licensed music at one point, and then all of a sudden it's your music, and you've got to be sort of a hybrid in a way?
A good question, and I've been asked that a number of times. Actually, I had no idea what licensed music.
Oh, you did?
I had no clue until I played the game.
You're doing your 40s, 50s, you know, 50s or early 60s imitation, because it's set in 1960.
Well, that, of course, you're thinking about it's set in 1960, but the score was not like Destroy All Humans was like imitating the scores of that period. BioShock was not. BioShock was just really scary music, and sometimes not just scary, but some very interesting opportunities creatively. Actually, I'll say this because I've said this a few times, but the most interesting music I have ever been asked to write has been for games. Really, truly, and if everybody has a chance to listen to the BioShock music, I think the music is interesting and was really fascinating for me and creatively challenging and wonderful to do. And I think that's also true of other games that I've like Dante's Inferno, which is set in hell. And I got to score hell, which was awesome for a composer, when I got to go to London and record with the Philharmonia Orchestra and the fantastic choirs that are available there. And so all that is like a great opportunity. And that a lot of films these days are, the music's quite ambient and may be very appropriate for the films, but are not all that interesting from a compositional perspective, at least not to me. So that's one of the cool things that games has afforded me, like really interesting.
You mentioned your most recent project. It was just released a couple of months ago, Torn. And this is a virtual reality game. Was there anything different? Was it like just doing a film or a game project? Or was there anything different about being immersed in a virtual reality game that you wanted to try to convey?
It's a very interesting game. And it's really like, I call it like a virtual movie. You're like really in this amazing atmosphere, and the story, it's very story centric and has a cinematic vibe to it, and has sort of a nice surprise Black Mirror kind of ending to it. But that said, the music was not compositionally or from a perspective of interactivity was not that different. No, it was really about serving the project and really doing something that felt emotionally appropriate for the game. And so it was a wonderful creative challenge, but it wasn't particularly unique in terms of like the you didn't have things swirling around your head in the score, which you can do because you're in a 3D, you know, full world. Everywhere you look, from your toes to your above you, is the world you're in. And after a while, because I, you know, having played this game, after a while you forget you're in virtual reality. You really start, your brain starts to just accept that is the real world. And it's quite interesting. But the of course, if you had music that's from some source, if you had a radio playing and you walk towards it, it gets louder. If you walk, if it's behind you, it's coming from behind you. But the score is really coming from a stereo field in front of you, because it's really all about setting some kind of a mood or emotional.
And just like in a film and television, your goal is to serve the story and serve the right. advancement of the story.
And why is the music there anyways? You know, there's no... You know why? I love that the High Anxiety. Have you ever seen the movie High
Yes.
Anxiety? And there's a scene in the beginning where Mel Brooks is being chauffeured from the airport, and all of a sudden he hears music, dramatic music, and he's looking around, and where's this music coming from? And then a bus pulls up next to him, and it has an orchestra in it. So, and of course there should be a bus in air or somewhere. Where is the orchestra coming from in Torn or in? E.T. or Star Wars, there is no sort. It's just, we just accept it, that it works, and thank goodness for that, or I would have not been selling shoes or something.
Gary Scheinman, thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
That is the award-winning video game, TV, and film composer Gary Scheinman in conversation with Rich Fisher. Scheinman is a J. Donald Fagen visiting artist here at TU. And he spoke with Rich Fisher last week. You're listening to Studio Tulsa, and on this election day, our commentator Connie Cronley would like to offer a bit of recent American legislative history and perhaps also a timely call to action.
Hey, Oklahoma, we've got a chance at redemption. We're in the Bible Belt. We like redemption and salvation, also damnation, but this is redemption, and not just for our state, but for the entire United States. And here's what it is. The Equal Rights Amendment. Remember that from the 70s? Here's what the proposed amendment says. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state on account of sex. And here's what happened. Congress approved ERA in March of 1972 and set a deadline for 3/4 of the states to ratify it. Only 35 states did, and 38 were needed. Now, some people are saying there oughtn't to have been a deadline. Let's have another shot at it. Last year, Nevada ratified the ERA amendment, and recently, so did Illinois. Just one more state to go. So here's our chance, Oklahoma. We could be the one. Of course, so could Alabama, Arkansas, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, half a dozen other states, but we don't have any hope for them. It could be us that makes history. I asked an expert on Oklahoma legislature what he thought the chances are. When he quit laughing, he said, "Slim, what it would take is an organized campaign to push for it, especially among state Republicans." Well, now we can all laugh. Why wasn't it ratified the first time when the majority of Americans approved it? Because one woman, a conservative activist named Phyllis Schlafly from St. Louis, almost single-handedly brought it down. She rallied opponents to take homemade bread and apple pies to state legislators with the slogans, "I am for mom and apple pie." Now, most of us had started calling ourselves Ms. about that time, even if we were married. But Mrs. Schlafly said the ERA could mean that women would be drafted into the U.S. military, be forced to use unisex bathrooms, and have to accept same-sex marriages. Bingo! Now, Mrs. Schlafly wasn't a stay-at-home mom herself. She was a lawyer, author, newspaper columnist, and failed political candidate. But she said that the ERA was anti-family and anti-American. In her obituary 3 years ago, the New York Times likened her to Carrie Nation, who fought for prohibition with a hatchet. What's not to like about equal rights for women? Well, it's a slippery slope to damnation, like, say, medical marijuana. By accident, I recently discovered a diary I kept for a few years in the 1970s. Rereading it depressed me for days. Women's Lib was news at the time, and I gave lots of talk about this new phenomenon. Many found the concept quaint or puzzling or even annoying. My diary is full of railings about my male bosses and their pushback to equal pay or job opportunities. I was working at a university at the time, which you'd think was enlightened and forward-thinking, but you would be wrong. What can we do but press on? And so, in salute of prohibition and women's liberation and ERA, I quote this poem by Philip Appleman, who is both an American poet and, how interesting is this, an expert on Darwin. "Oh, karma, dharma, pudding and pie, give me a break before I die. Grant me wisdom, will, and wit, purity, probity, pluck, and grit. Trustworthy, loyal, helpful, kind, give me great abs and a steel-trap mind. And forgive ye God some humble advice. These little blessings would suffice to beget an earthly paradise. Make the bad people good and the good people nice. And before our world goes over the brink, teach the believers how to think."
Connie Cronley is a writer and longtime contributor to this program. Her latest book is a collection of essays from OU Press called Poke a Stick at It, Unexpected True Stories. And I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. Please do not forget to vote today. And thank you for listening.